You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. We owe the authors of Hiding in Plain Sight, The Pursuit of War Criminals from Nuremberg to the War on Terror, I think, a great debt. As historian Adam Hochschild remarked, quote, "This is destined to be an essential work in the field of human rights for years to come. The author's lively writing ensures that the book can be read by all of us, not just legal professionals," unquote. One of the cases the book examines is the pursuit of war criminal Charles Taylor. The authors quote David Crane, the special court's first prosecutor, who masterminded the attempt to bring Taylor to justice. He said, quote, "The success or failure of prosecutions hinges on a full understanding of politics and diplomacy to ensure justice at the end of the day." Reading chapters of the book over the last few days, I was amazed at the complexity of the efforts, legal, logistical, international, to bring war criminals like Charles Taylor to justice. I thought of a young man I know, Sheikhou Mansoure from Sierra Leone, who just finished graduate school, and I personally want to dedicate this evening to Sheikhou, who came to the United States in his teens from war-torn Sierra Leone. To Sheikhou, the capture and prosecution of Charles Taylor was a deeply meaningful event. Sheikhou has two hooks instead of arms, hacked off by rebel soldiers who also killed his parents in front of him under the rule of Charles Taylor. Thanks to an international effort, Charles Taylor was found guilty in April 2012 of all 11 charges levied by the special court for Sierra Leone, including murder, terror, and rape. And in May 2012, he was sentenced to 50 years in prison. Our three guests tonight base their book on years of research and in-depth interviews with prosecutors, investigators, and diplomats. The three authors are, and I'm going to give you the briefest of bios, there's more on our website, Alexa Koenig, the executive director of the Human Rights Center and a lecturer in residence at UC Berkeley. She teaches classes on human rights and international criminal law. Victor Peskin, an associate professor in the School of Politics and Global Studies at Arizona State University, and research fellow at the UC Berkeley Human Rights Center. His current work focuses on the politics of accountability in Kosovo and the role of the International Criminal Court in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And Eric Stover, faculty director of the Human Rights Center and adjunct professor of law and public health at UC Berkeley. In the early 90s, Eric took part in conducting the first research on the social and medical consequences of landmines in Cambodia, and his research helped launch the international campaign to ban landmines. And before we begin tonight, let me just read an excerpt from the most memorable and oft-quoted prosecutorial statements in modern history, which you'll find on page 43 of this seminal book, given by the chief American prosecutor, Justice Robert Jackson, at the opening of the Nuremberg trial on November 30th, 1945. Quote, "The wrongs which we seek to condemn and punish have been so calculated, so malignant, and so devastating that civilization cannot tolerate their being ignored because it cannot survive their being repeated. We must never forget that the record on which we judge these defendants..."
This whole system of laws that was put into place in the aftermath of World War II and has grown and matured over the last 75 years. One of the most exciting things about working on this book has really been the opportunity, as Louise mentioned, to go out there and learn from some of the people who have helped to craft, to design, and to shape that framework, and to find out what they managed to do to make this system one that could ideally begin to find justice for survivors of mass atrocity. The book spans, as was mentioned, everything from the trials in the aftermath of World War II, the Nuremberg trials. It goes up through the development of the international criminal tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda. It talks about the evolution of hybrid trials that were put together, or hybrid tribunals that were put together to combine and to marry international criminal law with domestic and national efforts. Up through the war on terror, and as we'll be mentioning briefly tonight, we see the moment of 9/11 as really engendering a split in that evolution. And there was a moment where a choice needed to be made about how we would seek justice in the aftermath of incredibly horrific incidents that ultimately came to impact people around the globe. Some key themes that come out of this book. First is, as I mentioned earlier, the interplay of the legal with the political and the operational. So to ultimately get people arrested, to get accountability, you need to have a legal framework that allows you to ultimately try them in a court of law. You need to have the operational ability to find those individuals, particularly when they go into hiding. And you need the political will. And what we ultimately kept coming back to in story after story from the individuals with whom we spoke was that that political will often became that critical element to ultimately seeing justice play out. The second major theme that we'll be touching on tonight is an idea of being bound versus unbound by the law. Obviously, when you're looking to get someone who's a president of a country, for example, behind bars, or you're trying to get someone who is otherwise politically powerful, a general, whatever, there's a tension there. And a lot of countries who have had to sign on to this framework over time have had to make a choice. Are they willing to be bound by legal dictates, or are they going to assert their sovereignty in a way that they want to remain unbound and free to do what they feel most expedient in the moment? In terms of the format, I'm going to turn in a second to both Victor and Eric, and then we'll open it up for questions toward the end. So Eric, for you in the beginning, the book opens with the flight of hundreds of people in the aftermath of World War II. Why does the book start there, and what does that tell us about the arrest problems today and how we can ultimately engender justice?
Okay. Thank you, everyone, for coming. It's a little hard to condense World War II until about 10 minutes, so, but I'll try and do my best. I'm going to leave Japan out of the picture. We actually talk about the Asian theater and the pursuit of war criminals there, but I'll really focus on Europe. So keeping in mind that this is a book of history, and again, we're looking at it operationally. So how do you go after these guys? Secondly, what's the legal means in which you can do it? And then, of course, the politics. So if we look at World War II, the way to understand the pursuit of war criminals there is really to put it into three periods of time. The first is pre-occupation, and that's from Normandy storming onto the beaches and moving across Europe. We had the Allied forces were coming in, the French, British, and others were coming in. Of course, the Soviets, Russians were coming in from the east. And at that point, the legal regime was in place, essentially, that there would be trials of the major Nazi war criminals across the spectrum. So that was in place. The London Charter for the Nuremberg Tribunal was in place. However, there was still an issue that was there, and that was the British, and particularly Churchill, as you'll probably know, weren't so sure that they wanted actual trials where there wouldn't be, why have these trials? Why not just execute them? Where Roosevelt was holding out, no, there should be, we should have a judicial process here. The other thing that's important is as the troops moved in, there was the Counterintelligence Corps. Now, the Counterintelligence Corps was developed during World War I, and it would move in with the U.S. troops, and it would sort of check out the neighborhood, were there snipers left behind, and so on. And many of the members of the Counterintelligence Corps were German-speaking, had lived in Europe. In fact, J.D. Salinger was a member of the Counterintelligence Corps. Alan Bank, who is founded the Green Berets, and Henry Kissinger was also a member of the Counterintelligence Corps. As they moved in with the troops, it wasn't until April, and May 8th is when, of course, the surrender is signed and sovereignty moves to the Allied powers, but it wasn't until April that Roosevelt finally made a decision that we're going to actually, even though there will be a court, we're going to go after these war criminals. So why did he wait? He waited because he was concerned that American troops and other Allied troops that were in the POW camps would be taken out by the Germans and executed. But by April, they were secure enough to feel that, yes, now we can give the order. Counterintelligence Corps is going to do these investigations. But what had happened to the Counterintelligence Corps was these men and women who went into the concentration camps were overwhelmed by what they saw. They were not prepared. They didn't have photographs of the potential war criminals who were there. And it was at first fairly chaotic. So that's to say, the beginning, so pre-occupation, was a fairly chaotic pursuit. By the time occupation takes place, we see several things happening. First of all, I actually want to show you, this is just a photograph of the Counterintelligence Corps here. And these are all photographs that we have in the book. So the next is Allied occupation. So that's really from May officially until December of 1945, December of 1949. And POW camps were established. Also, a denazification program was set up by all of the Allied powers in which those members of the Nazi parties were vetted. Some were sent to prison. Others were dismissed from their jobs, from teachers to business or whatever. So there was this process of denazification. And in the POW camps, frequently, because the SS officers, so people like Joseph Mengele and Eichmann and others went through these camps. Actually, survivors from the concentration camps would come into the camps and try and identify who were the SS officers. Now, it was easy to do that because the SS officers usually had their blood type either on their arm or on their chest. Interestingly, Joseph Mengele, as you know, who's the doctor at Auschwitz, never did. And so he was actually captured, but was never identified, and was later able to escape. And then, of course, there was the Nuremberg trials that were established. So what we see is this massive effort to make all of these arrests. But the interesting thing happened, and this is as we push up towards the late 1949, and that was that the Soviet menace was beginning to trouble the West, and particularly the United States. And so there was this sense we have to back off from these trials, back off from these arrests, because it's going to undermine the German people. And at the same time, we began realizing we needed to grab some of the scientific know-how among the German scientists. So we brought over about 764 German scientists to the United States under Operation Paperclip, and many of those were actually involved. We wanted information, we wanted the knowledge they had on some submarine design, chemical weapon production, and missile technology. But over half to 80% of them had been members of the Nazi Party. Some of them had been involved in abuses. So all of a sudden, this political change is taking place in which we're no longer, and we're going to see this happen throughout history, it's no longer because of the Soviet menace that we're actually going to turn our back on justice, essentially. So what happens is also there were rat lines established, you may have heard of, and that were that many of the top Nazi, some from Eichmann to Mengele to Barbie, who was the Gestapo chief in Lyon, they all got onto these rat lines run by a Catholic a Croatian priest out of in Italy, and they went off to various countries around the world. One of the sort of scandals that arose from that was the fact that at the end of the war, Klaus Barbie was giving intelligence to the Central Intelligence Corps, and they actually put him on a rat line, and he made it all the way to Bolivia, where he lived until he was eventually extradited. So then, just to wrap up, after this period, the trials end, and we end into the post-occupation period. And what's interesting here is the U.S., the Allied powers, really aren't going to pursue these war criminals anymore. The trials are over. The Germans aren't going to do it at this point. And all of a sudden, and this is a theme we see in our book, is that we have rise of individuals, the individual so-called Nazi hunters. from Simon Wiesenthal, and you know the Simon Wiesenthal Center here in L.A., to Serge and Mitra Klarsfeld, they based in Paris, and Tuvia Friedman, who is a Polish Jew who was held in a labor camp, and they start going after these Nazis who fled throughout the world. And to show you, this is, and they started using techniques like this is Vita Klarsfeld, who was German herself, and this happened in 1967. And Kurt George Kessinger, who is the chancellor who's just taken over the Christian Democrat, is giving a speech in Germany, and she gets up and shouts at him, "I am," and actually was closer to him than you see in this photograph, slapped him, and said, "This is the German you slapping the Nazi past," because he had been a Nazi propagandist in the past. So they started using this techniques to try and change the political discourse. So moving ahead to the captures that we saw, Adolf Eichmann was captured in 1960 in Argentina, where he had fled. And this was the Sinbad, Israeli Sinbad, that went after him, the Mossad, and captured him and caused a big uproar because they abducted him and took him back to Israel, where he was tried and convicted. And then the last slide I'll show here again is Klaus Barbie. He made it all the way to Bolivia. He actually was a advisor to the military government on range from torture to special operations and so on. Finally, the French brought him back, and he was tried in 1983 and convicted there. So what happens, basically, justice really goes into the deep freeze of the Cold War. But what we see in the 1990s or 1980s is as the Soviet Union, the Americans, the Cold War starts to thaw, all of a sudden, and this is really underappreciated in historians, and I feel in human rights who write about, is that local human rights organizations around the world, from Argentina to the Philippines to Romania, to all started coming out and demanding justice and accountability. And this is where we see another change, and there's going to be another question of how do we go after these criminals in this new phase in the 1980s and 1990s.
So we have this deep freeze in the aftermath of World War II. So this first flicker of the evolution of international criminal law as a way to deal with these atrocities. And then in the 1980s, the late 80s, we begin to see the thawing of the Cold War and the rise of the new ad hoc tribunals, most notably the Tribunal for the Former Yugoslavia and Rwanda. So Victor, what does this experience of this evolution of contemporary ad hoc tribunals and the evolution of the International Criminal Court, which came out of that, ultimately mean for when and how we're going to see global justice and how we can make it work?
Sure, Alexa, thanks so much for that essential question. Well, in contrast to Nuremberg and Tokyo, today's international tribunals and the ICC, International Criminal Court, have a monumental and enduring challenge. At Nuremberg, you had an occupying army, at least, right? So arrests were pretty easy in comparison to today. You had people who fled to Argentina, of course, many, many thousands who fled. But you had enforcement powers. Today's tribunals do not have a global LAPD at their beck and call. This is a huge problem. So on its face, a lot of people, optimists as well at some point, activists too, were initially pessimistic about the prospects of the Yugoslavia tribunal actually succeeding. You had institutions in place in The Hague, you had law, but you did not have a political will, which is so essential. But at the same time, the comparison between different tribunals underscores how political will can make international justice succeed and fail. It depends. So I want to show you the first slide of a wanted poster of today that we have in our book of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, which is in Tanzania. It indicted approximately 90 suspects in connection with the genocide in Rwanda. Today, we have 8 fugitives who are at large. It's a pretty successful arrest record. Then moving on to this next slide, this was a picture, I believe, in Sarajevo in the late 1990s of Radovan Karadzic and Ratko Mladic, Bosnian Serb commanders, as you may know. In the early days of the Yugoslavia Tribunal, the problem of arrest was monumental. Still, over time, as I will explain, all the indicted suspects were accounted for. Some died before their capture, but essentially most of the 161 suspects had been arrested and handed over for trial. It's quite a remarkable record. It's quite a remarkable record. So this shows international justice has an ability to succeed under certain political conditions. If we go to the International Criminal Court, we see Karadzic, who was a New Age healer. He hid out in Belgrade at a point. But if we go to the International Criminal Court here, a new premises that were just opened a year ago, I believe. And here is the cover photo of our book. And in the center is Omar al-Bashir, the head of state of Sudan, who's under indictment for genocide and crimes against humanity in connection with atrocities in Darfur, Sudan. So the International Criminal Court's experience vis-a-vis Sudan is a disappointing one. So Bashir was indicted for genocide in 2009, and 3 other Sudanese officials were also indicted. The 4 of them remain fugitives hiding in plain sight up until today. So we see a contrast between the Yugoslavia and Rwanda tribunals on the one hand and the International Criminal Court in Sudan on the other hand. Success and failure in terms of arrests. The International Criminal Court more generally has been able to gain custody of approximately half of its 32 indicted suspects. So not bad there, but not great. But the Sudan example pretty much stands out for explanation. So in light of the lack of enforcement powers, all tribunals and the tribunal chief prosecutors and human rights activists and victim groups, individuals, as Eric also said, have to become political, have to lobby international political actors such as NATO, the European Union, to pressure targeted states to hand over suspects. So that's the name of the game, a political and a social pressure. And in the case of the former Yugoslavia, if we go back here, the tribunal chief prosecutors first put pressure on the NATO peacekeepers who were sent to Bosnia after the Dayton Accords to arrest Karadzic and Mladic and scores of other suspects who had been indicted. But what actually happened at first in 1996 and 97 and 98, NATO commanders wanted to have nothing to do with arresting Karadzic and Mladic, primarily because of fear of troop casualties. So slowly, the chief prosecutors, especially in activists, shamed NATO into taking action and arresting scores of Bosnian Serbs and Croats. So that's the good news. The bad news is scores of Bosnian Serb suspects especially crossed over into Mother Serbia and enjoyed a protection of the tribunal had another problem. How to compel Serbia to hand over suspects widely regarded as war heroes? It's a difficult ask. It's very hard, right? So the key to that is activists and chief prosecutor pressure on the European Union especially to press Belgrade and Zagreb, Croatia, into handing over suspects. So in order to use your pressure, you have a couple options. You can threaten punishments, or you can offer rewards and carrots. The European Union had a perfect system of leverage, and it was to condition Serbia's a desired advancement toward European Union admission in terms of handing over suspects, right? So the European Union used its leverage to advance Serbia along the path to membership slowly in terms of handing over suspects. But the Serbian government played it very deviously in terms of handing over small fry suspects for as long as possible, but delaying the handover of Karadzic and Mladic for as long as possible. So around 2008 for Karadzic, the European Union made ultimatums, and 2011 for Mladic, and ultimately the Serbian authorities handed over all its suspects. So that's a very hopeful and successful case. So turning to Sudan and the International Criminal Court, just to highlight Bashir's alleged crimes, the International Criminal Chief Prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda of Gambia here, her press, the chief prosecutor who came before her indicted him for genocide in connection with the murder of 300,000 people in Darfur a decade ago. But the crimes actually continue in Darfur. According to Amnesty International, the Sudanese armed forces committed 30 chemical weapons attacks, primarily targeting children and babies, up until this past September, killing 250 people. So attacks continue. We don't hear much about it, however. And so Bensouda and others who work at the court and activists have pressed the UN Security Council, which I had actually called upon the International Criminal Court in the first place to investigate Darfur. She repeatedly makes calls for his arrest, and she is virtually ignored. And so meanwhile, if we go back to this classic photo here, you see Bashir hiding and traveling in plain sight. This is a photo that we chose for the cover because it pretty much encapsulates the problem of arrest and hiding in plain sight. Here he is in Nairobi, Kenya in August 2010 to celebrate the inauguration of the Kenyan Constitution. In all, Bashir, since his indictment, has traveled internationally 131 times, including to 17 state parties such as Kenya and South Africa, who are obligated to arrest him but haven't. So if you have state parties who obligate to follow the rules of the Rome Statute of the court and do not, it creates a monumental problem and underscores the essential role of political will. The African Union in particular has been a great supporter of Bashir, and it's a problem. But at the same time, it's important to look at an array of other global actors who have pretty much sidelined the International Criminal Court, such as our government. Last Friday, Barack Obama decided to relieve a major part of the sanctions regime on Sudan, which is still an official sponsor of state terrorism. So his decision comes despite the attacks of last year. And Human Rights Watch calls it an inexplicable decision and softening of pressure. But most of all, it undermines the prerogative and imperative of the ICC to one day try him for genocide and crimes against humanity. So if I could end on a hopeful note, politics do change at times, and we saw that in the Balkans, and we saw that in Sierra Leone, and so hopefully it will change again vis-a-vis Sudan and other cases I haven't had the opportunity to speak about yet.
Thank you. So we have the evolution of the International Criminal Court, as Victor mentioned, coming out of the development of these ad hoc tribunals for Yugoslavia and Rwanda, et cetera. The interesting thing about the ICC and what comes next is that the International Criminal Court, the Rome Statute that brought the court into being, was passed in 1998. Between 1998 and 2002, when the court began operations, there was this effort to get enough countries to sign on to the court that it could legally come into operation. Of course, what happens right before 2002 when they have the necessary number of signatures? But on September 11th, 2001, we have the attack on the United States at the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And all of a sudden, you see this shift. Whereas the United States had been, for the most part, a supporter of this evolution and the development of this framework of courts to begin to address mass atrocity, you suddenly see this conflict with what they feel they need to effectuate next. And this is where we begin to see this split in the road. Whereas it had been kind of this path that went underground or under ice or underwater for a while during the Cold War and reemerged and began to look like it was really a moment in history where law would become the solution to a lot of the challenges of the present day, you see two paths begin to form. And we've been calling it being bound and unbound by the law. So in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, you all of a sudden have the passing of what was called Operation Greystone. And what Operation Greystone was a directive issued forth by then President Bush that ultimately gave the CIA a tremendous amount of power and a tremendous amount of authority to determine how we would respond in the aftermath of that particular atrocity. It went ahead and it set up a regime of what were known as secret renditions, whereby individuals who were believed to be affiliated with terrorism were picked up at different locations around the globe, and ultimately, often under cover of darkness, rendered to other countries for what we now know was torture and other forms of enhanced interrogation. That being a phrase that was used repeatedly to talk about using tactics for interrogation purposes that were above and beyond what we had seen previously and what had previously been authorized. We also see with Operation Greystone the beginning of our new drone program. So whereas during the period of the genocide in the former Yugoslavia and the atrocities there, we'd been using drones predominantly for surveillance purposes, all of a sudden you have the arming of drones and the ability to use them to take out individuals who are believed, again, to be affiliated with terrorism. So the tricky thing, though, is that now the CIA has this directive to go out there and gather people up. But the CIA has never run prisons, and they're beginning to bring in more and more people, and they have to figure out what to do with them. So just as an illustration, in terms of what happens next and the two paths that we begin to walk, one example of what happened was the story of Abu Zubaydah, and Abu Zubaydah is one of the individuals we speak about in the book. He was the operations commander for Al-Qaeda, and he became the first person in United States custody to be subjected to this process of enhanced interrogation. One of the things that we now know happened was that the military and other government agencies began to talk with two psychologists in particular, an individual named Bruce Jessen and an individual named James Mitchell, who reverse engineered a program known as Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape, otherwise known by the acronym SEER. That particular program had been developed in the aftermath of the Korean War to teach military personnel, who are U.S. military personnel, how to survive a torture regime should they be captured. What they did in terms of reverse engineering this was to take the training that they gave those military personnel and begin to extract from that the techniques that had been used to torture individuals and to begin to put them into the toolbox of what could potentially be done if, and I think this is now a very infamous quote, the gloves came off, and we were to take a much more aggressive response to what had happened. So we began, in terms of trying to figure out what we would do with these individuals, Abu Zubaydah was ultimately captured in Faisalabad. The way he was ultimately found is that a number of different analysts were going through cell phone records, they were going through credit card records, and they ultimately began to build a network of individuals and how they were related to each other. And there was this big operation whereby they ultimately pinpointed where he probably was to 14 locations around the world, and then they dropped it even further. And on a particular day, they did an operation at 7 different locations and did ultimately apprehend Zubaydah. At that point, they flew him to a CIA jail near Bangkok, and from there took him on to Poland, and that's where the enhanced interrogations took place. We now know about those interrogations in part because of a leaked report that came out from the ICRC, The International Committee of the Red Cross is allowed to go in and to look at detainee conditions, and they had an opportunity to interview 14 what were considered high-value detainees about their treatment in those facilities. That information was leaked out to the public in 2009, which is how we now know about that program. So we have this really, this going of underground, this going dark, that we're doing things on the dark side, that we're going to keep the program secret. This is in direct contrast to what that we then did during the same era with, of course, Saddam Hussein of Iraq. As you probably remember, on March 19th of 2003, we entered into a war with Iraq. We brought tens of thousands of ground troops to the country in the attempt to actually find Saddam Hussein and remove him from power. We often think of this, even though some of the practices there may have been questionable, it's a much more visible and much more traditional method of trying to go after an individual and get him or her into custody. Ultimately, they used very similar methods to find Saddam Hussein as they did for Abu Zubaydah. They engaged in a process of network analysis, whereby they began to figure out the relationships among different peoples and particularly different families in Iraq to begin to try to pinpoint where Saddam Hussein was. Now, one of the tricky things in finding him is that he realized that his greatest weakness could ultimately be his ties to his family, to his friends. And this is a theme that recurs repeatedly throughout the book, is that when people are apprehended who are trying to hide from accountability, it's often this little slip where they either get a little bit more complacent or they want to touch base with a child who they haven't talked to in years, that it provides an opening. Here, what ended up happening is that he had actually escaped another attempt to detain him back in the 1950s, and he had gone to a particular farm, and as people were closing in on capturing him, he had swum across the river, and he had, as they, I think we say in the book, rode off in the sunset to become this future leader of Iraq. Well, it turns out he went to the same farm. Eventually, we were able to use the network analysis to pinpoint a relationship to one of five families to with whom he was particularly close. One of the individuals who was apprehended from one of those five families ultimately gave up the information about the farm where he was likely hiding. And when the U.S. went in to go get him and couldn't locate where he was hiding, actually walked over and tapped on a piece of dirt. And when they brushed away the dirt, they found a mat. And when they took away the mat, they found a hole. And down in that was Saddam Hussein. So what he represents is after that time period, he was turned over to the Iraq Provisional Government, and he ultimately was subjected to a trial in a court of law, which again really contrasts with the form of justice that we see playing out through our process of enhanced interrogation. This is, of course, one of the infamous pictures from Abu Ghraib. One of the things that we saw is that there was tremendous fear in the aftermath of 9/11 of letting go of anyone who had been detained, because a lot of the U.S. government was really concerned that if they let people go and they turned out to effectuate another terrorist attack on the United States, no one wanted to be that person. So what we found is that our prison systems became very impacted. We, of course, had individuals who were considered the quote-unquote worst of the worst sent out to Guantanamo Bay. A lot of our systems and processes that we would have used historically to screen people on the battlefield were not used in this particular situation. And so we, of course, ended up, as we now know, with a number of people, particularly at Guantanamo, who for whom there was never any evidence of actual terrorist activity. So this visibility and this how much we follow the dictates of what we've done in the past, how much we use law as a tool becomes really important. One last comment that I'll make, since I know we're getting low on time, is something else that becomes really notable during this time period is how much the United States began to come up with legal memos to try and say we're actually adhering to the dictates of law. But at the same time, we're manipulating the laws in ways that I think for a lot of human rights lawyers at the time were highly problematic and were concerning because they were giving a latitude that under international legal standards and this big push that we were making at the time around the globe to strengthen that international legal framework, that those were beginning to be in tension with what the United States said that it would be doing. So it's in a nutshell. I'd like to, in the few minutes we have left before we open it up to questions, I'd like to turn to both Eric and Victor and ask, okay, so given this history, what comes next for international justice?
I'll let Victor start on that one.
I was just about to say the same for Eric. I think... under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, a key principle is complementarity. And complementarity encourages states and state sovereignty. So it calls upon state parties to the court to try their own first before the ICC intervenes. So I think that we've already seen such a movement, and we'll see a bigger shift toward complementarity and domestic justice. At the same time, you have a new ad hoc a hybrid court set up for the crimes of the Kosovo Liberation Army in Kosovo, and that is a kind of a hybrid regional court set up. I'm researching that, and I think that stands as a model of a new type of hybrid regional type of court that we may see for several examples elsewhere. And we'll also see international criminal court investigations. On that score, though, it's important to caution the ICC has been in business now for almost 15 years, and because it's a global court, or aspires to be, it's opened 8 country investigations, a 9th one actually, a Georgian-Russian conflict of 2008. So it tries to spread itself out there nobly, but because of that, it doesn't have resources to plunge too deeply per any given conflict. So for the 9 country situations in 15 years, you have a total of 32 people who've been publicly indicted. So you're not going to get a lot of justice in terms of indictees. So it underscores the importance of supporting a complementarity and rule of law efforts everywhere we can.
So I would, so I'll focus a little bit on the United States. And I think the way to look at the future, and even going back in time a bit, goes back to what Alexa had originally mentioned, that one of the, when you pursue war criminals, when you pursue criminals in the streets of LA or anywhere, you do it bound by the law, that you will follow the law, or you can be get a little unbound by the law. And I want to go back to the case that Alexa brought up, because this illustrates it. When Zubaydah was captured and taken to Bangkok, where the CIA was running a black site, the 2 psychologists he mentioned from the CIA were to come in, and also the FBI. And they were going to come in, and Zubaydah, this is the first alleged terrorist who's being picked up that we know of, and they're going to begin the interrogation, and they're going to do it in this black site outside of Bangkok. The FBI actually arrives there early, and they start interrogating Zubaydah, and then the 2 psychologists come in representing the CIA. When the CIA, when these 2 psychologists arrived, the CIA staff actually sent a telegram back to Alex Station, which was the CIA's special unit back in Washington, D.C., or in the environs of Washington, D.C., who were directing the war on terror. And that telegram, or that message that went back, that it was a telegram showing my age, was essentially, we're worried because these interrogators that have come in from the CIA are, he has heart trouble, and we're worried that something could happen to him because he's being waterboarded and other extreme forms of interrogation. And we're also concerned if he goes, is he ever going to know, see the light of day? Is he ever going to be public? Because he could talk about this, is essentially what they were saying. Meanwhile, what had happened is the FBI pulled out. And they said, the FBI also pulled out of interrogations in Guantanamo. Why did the FBI pull out? Because the FBI, whatever, you know, transgressions they may have throughout history, and there have been, is they know when they make an arrest and they make an interrogation, a judge is going to be watching over what they've done, and it can be exposed in court. And they weren't going to be part of this, and they pulled out. But here what you had were the CIA staff going back and asking, and what came back from Alex Station was, don't worry about his health, and it's unlikely he's ever going to go public. So, you know, so they were completely unbound by the law. And I think as we go forward, this is the question we're going to have to watch, is that we uphold the law, and that in the pursuits of terrorists, alleged terrorists, and of course, is that are we going to be bound by the law and understand that the law is what really directs us, or are we going to leave ourselves unbound by the law? And that's the big challenge I think we face.
And the last thing I'll say before we open up to questions is I think we also can't underestimate the power of time. And I think time is so powerful because of the politics that go along with it. One recurring theme we saw as we were writing the book is that there's often a cycle, a life cycle to justice. So in the immediate aftermath of some atrocity, there's so much momentum and so much anger and so much horror at what's happened that there's this momentum to do something. And then often as that becomes politically challenging or operationally challenging, people are hiding out. It goes underground for a while. But we see this cycle that a generation later, as children, and I think Eric brought this up with the Klarsfelds earlier, as children rediscover, you know, the sins of their fathers or whatever, they ultimately rediscover there's a new momentum to actually see justice done. And we see that recurring throughout history. So sometimes when some of the most politically powerful people in the world, you can't go after them and actually get countries to pursue them because of the political trade-offs that they'd have to make for getting those people into custody. You often wait until 20, 30 years later when they are weaker politically, their friends may have died off or have lost positions of power, and suddenly there's an opening in a moment. And I think then what it becomes incumbent on everyone to do is make sure the legal framework is in place and the operational tactics are in place that moment can be grabbed when it finally exists. So on that, I'd like to open it up now to the audience for our last 10 minutes. Yes, sir.
When Glenn Greenwald was speaking at UCLA Law School a few years ago, he said that as long as the United States has the military and economic preeminence in the world that it does now, that it's very unlikely that George W. Bush and Dick Cheney will ever be brought up on war crimes charges, either domestically or internationally. Do you share that assessment? And if so, to what extent does that undercut the moral legitimacy of international efforts to bring war criminals to justice when African war criminals can be prosecuted, but American ones can't?
So maybe I'll start with that one. One, we have seen a number of human rights lawyers, et cetera, attempt to bring cases against the individuals known as the Bush Six, so the six people deemed most responsible for some of the torture that was allegedly perpetrated. What we're seeing happen is when you go after these really powerful political actors, what gives way is often not their cases, but the law itself. So there's a doctrine known as universal jurisdiction, which many of you may know about, and that doctrine basically says that there are some crimes that are so horrific that any country in the world should be able to hold trials for that wrongdoing. Even if the person who perpetrated it is not from that country, even if the survivor's not or the victim's not from that country, and even if the crimes did not take place on that soil. And so what lawyers have been trying to do is use that doctrine to say we should be able to bring this case in Spain or in Germany, etc. But what we've seen, unfortunately, is that when those cases have been brought, those countries are actually weakening this doctrine and saying, you know what, universal jurisdiction isn't as all powerful as that. We're actually going to require, under our domestic laws, some kind of nexus, something, in order to allow this to go forward. And I think there's an impression that maybe that's because the political trade-offs are going to be too high for those countries. In the immediate aftermath, or while all this was going on during the first decade of the 21st century, we had a number of out clauses that we were also trying to push forward. So there were bilateral immunity acts that were passed with countries to which we would normally give foreign aid. And it was a piece of paper that we would say, all right, in exchange for this aid, we want you to sign this piece of paper that will say that you will never turn a U.S. citizen over to the International Criminal Court for prosecution. In addition to these agreements, we ended up passing an act called the American Service Members Protection Act. And the idea behind the act, writ large, was that it would be a provision to protect people who are peacekeepers, who are U.S. troops on the ground in conflict areas from ever being prosecuted for anything that might happen there. But ultimately, this particular act got the nickname the Invade the Hague Act, because it included within it a provision that said if anyone in the world turned a U.S. citizen over to The Hague again for prosecution, we reserve the right to militarily invade The Hague and extract that individual by force. So, you know, I think the tricky thing, again, going back to my theme on timing, is that you have to find those openings where those individuals are not so politically powerful, so the trade-offs are not seem so extreme, and then I think you'll see law strengthening itself again and the world coming together to see prosecutions. Anyone else want to touch on that?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, predictions is a very rough science, so it's hard, you know, I could eat my words 2 years from now, but I doubt we're going to see those prosecutions taking place. Something may happen, but I think with the president-elect coming to power, I don't think we're going to see that in the future.
The prior question brings up the more fundamental question. First of all, I salute you. Your book sounds fantastic. Look forward to reading it. I wonder whether your book actually addresses the definition of a war crime. Throw out a couple, not taking a position, the firebombing of Dresden, the firebombing of Tokyo, Christmas bombing by Nixon in 72, Kissinger giving carte blanche in East Timor. One could go on, and when you bring up Bush and Cheney, I think for most of us it's not simply about illegal or improper interrogations, but overthrowing an old civilization, albeit run by a bad dictator, but a place where women could work and people were getting along, as long as you weren't Shiite. So there's a lot of things that go on in life, and presumably it's not just regime change that we're against. You know, what is the definition of a war crime? We know it can't simply be based on a body count, because if it was a body count, then Hiroshima and Nagasaki would presumably be in Webster's under the definition. Thanks.
Well, I think maybe let's go to Nuremberg. And what we know about the Nuremberg trials, and there's no denying that they had a tremendous effect, but what we now know looking back at the Nuremberg trials is that they were political. This was victor's justice. We had occupied Germany. But the intent there, and there were cameras there, they were filming the trials. And the reason for it was that we wanted to show, the Americans, but also the British had bought into this, we wanted to show the rest of Europe that this is what a totalitarian regime, the Nazi regime, the Third Reich, had been. And it was political. There was discussion as to, you know, would we look at our own crimes? The firebombing of Dresden, which thousands and tens of thousands of civilians died. And the decision was no, we wouldn't do that, that we would reflect only on the crimes committed by the Germans. When we see the courts in the 1990s come along, that changes. And the idea is that you're going to look at a conflict and you're going to look at all the combatants in the conflict. I mean, in terms of how do you define a war crime or how do you define crimes against humanity and genocide, which are the most serious international crimes. That's a long seminar about how we would define that. But essentially, what is agreed upon in the Geneva Conventions of 1949, where we sign on to, is that war is going to happen, but we are going to respect prisoners of war. That when those soldiers are hors de combat, when they no longer have their weapons, they're being held, they will not be tortured and abused. They will have contacts with their families. We are going to protect clinics and hospitals and places of worship. Civilians should be protected. The notion is that any commander, when they're gauging an attack, has to take in effect proportionality. It's all right that you're going to attack Zagreb or a town, but you're going to have to think about what are the civilian casualties going to be. The problem is it's all in the hands of the commander. And if they don't follow the Geneva Conventions, then war crimes are committed. When you come to a crime like crimes against humanity, that's a crime in which you're looking at how when the Serbs took over Srebrenica, and the men and boys fled in 1995, am I right? 94, 95. 95, yeah. And they fled in July of 1995. that those, when they captured the Bosnian Muslim men and boys, they were executed in different places. I actually worked on the exhumations there. And the crimes against humanity is defined that this was systematic. It had taken place across and widespread, and so that would be held as a crime. When you get to war crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity, there's a great pressure on the prosecutor to really have sound evidence, because the sentences, the penalties that are going to be quite high. So we're going to see through history, and have seen through history, that certain people who we would allege that are war criminals are going to get away with it, and there are others that are not. And it really hinges on political will and the sort of the desire to as we saw in the 1990s, to really go after these sorts of criminals. And now I think we're definitely in a waning period where, in fact, I don't think the International Criminal Court is going to collapse, but it's certainly losing support that it's had in many countries around the world.
And I think we have time for maybe one more question. We have more time. Oh, good. Oh, perfect. Great.
Thank you. Some societies have chosen alternatives to prosecution, like truth and reconciliation commissions in South Africa, and I think Rwanda as well. In Spain, there was just amnesty granted. They thought that was the best way to handle atrocities. Do you view those alternatives as failures of justice?
Victor, do you want to take that one?
I think that one of the criticisms of the movement for international criminal justice is that some critics view it as not allowing alternatives. A kind of question I get from students is, in terms of South Africa's a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was in the 1990s prior to the creation of the International Criminal Court, but would the ICC today have recognized the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and pretty much deferred to the South African choice? Ultimately, the ICC prosecutor has a jurisdiction over grave crimes. I think that if you are talking about the most serious international crimes, such as genocide and crimes against humanity, there should be a judicial criminal option. And you can also have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission at the same time. You can have complementary approaches, and it has been tried in Sierra Leone. It's not always successful. So essentially, it doesn't have to be either or. Sometimes it is.
I just would add, just on South Africa, when the African National Congress comes to power, they faced a horrible situation, because of all the crimes under apartheid, you would have had tens of thousands of people that you should have prosecuted. That the ANC and Mandela himself, we can't afford that. And some societies will decide, if we have criminal trials, we're going to divide this country even worse. And so they'll go with the Truth Commission model or other reparations. That has to be the decision of that society. If the Chilean government doesn't want to pursue trials like the Argentines did, then the population isn't ready for it, then that decision, I think, has to rest with the people themselves as well. And clearly in South Africa, it was a question of it would have been just too tremendous a task to have tried everyone.
I just wondered if you know, with the recent peace accord in Colombia, what is the approach that is being taken there?
I'm going to have to pass on that. I'm really not that well versed in any of you.
Same for me. I know some, but not enough to weigh in authoritatively.
Thank you.
I think most Americans would subscribe to the view that the major task of the country's leader would be to protect the homeland and its citizens. And so if you're in a conflict and you have to perform certain acts in order to shorten the war or protect the homeland, you do whatever is necessary. And that, therefore, in World War II, if it takes a bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima to save a million American soldiers, you do it. And I wonder if that isn't really a question of what is a war crime. And I think most Americans would say that if you're protecting the homeland and you're protecting its citizens, you do what you have to do, and that's not a war crime.
So one thing I would bring up about that is that there are a number of different standards in international law. And obviously war does allow for killings. Not every killing during the course of a war is going to be considered an illegal killing. A couple of the principles that come up are necessity. Certainly proportionality is another one. Certainly in looking at the practice of using drones, conducting drone strikes, that's been a big issue is, are the number of individuals being killed by drone strikes, is that actually minimizing the amount of harm that's being done to individuals on the ground if we were to take some other kind of operational method? What I'd personally love to see is more research that actually looks into where there's more releasing of the facts around numbers and data so we can have a better understanding of this issue of necessity and proportionality, and what are some of the facts around when different tactics may minimize the harm overall while maximizing the ultimate military objective.
I haven't read your book, so forgive me. So what I'm hearing tonight is mainly it's European-based law emanating from the Nuremberg tribunals and trials. Have the Asians or the Southeast Asians, specifically Myanmar, Cambodia, even the Japanese in relation to Korea, etc., what has the ICC done to work with those entities, those countries, and South Asia, let alone India and Pakistan?
So do you want to talk about Cambodia? In terms of International Criminal Court, it's opened a range of preliminary investigations, Israel, Palestine, Honduras at one point, North Korea, which still might be on the preliminary docket. But in terms of formal investigations that are leading to indictments, you have 8 country situations in Africa and the Russian-Georgian conflict of 2008 I mentioned. And so it hasn't ventured into Asia at this point formally. But in terms of the Cambodia tribunal, Eric spent a lot of time.
The two tribunals we've seen since the 1990s in Asia, I'm sure I'm correct here, is East Timor. And that was known as a hybrid tribunal with international national members on the court. That wasn't a very successful tribunal for many reasons. The Cambodia, the extraordinary court in the chambers of the ECCC, I always mess this up, the extraordinary court in the chambers of Cambodia, has been somewhat successful, and they have been prosecuting the surviving leaders of the Khmer Rouge. And the first case they took on was a man by the name of Doik, who was the commander of the Tuol Salang prison in Phnom Penh, where thousands of people were tortured and died. Very few people survived. So there has been that effort nationally, working internationally and nationally, but it's not been as extensive as it has in Europe and in Latin America.
Was that due to the French influence in Cambodia?
Well, I think what you found in Cambodia was time passes, and the court, given that we're talking about the Khmer Rouge period from 75 to 1979, it wasn't until the 90s the court eventually comes around. The interesting thing is many Cambodian children, teenagers, older young people, aren't aware of the Khmer Rouge period. It was something that was never talked about. So this court actually opened up, and they had a television program on every Sunday that they would show scenes from the court, and it started us in the country to talk about their past history, which had been essentially hidden. So that has some good benefits.
And then in terms of the International Criminal Court, they're definitely investigating a much broader number of countries and conflicts than where they currently have active cases being run. I think another thing we tend to disregard or not value enough is the cost involved with a lot of these and the ways that the International Criminal Court is set up to make impact. So we have a colleague at the Human Rights Center that has pointed out that the budget for the Office of the Prosecutor, at least last year, was approximately equivalent to that of the police in the city of Berkeley. And their jurisdiction is the entire globe. So how do you effectively run cases that broadly with a budget that small? So that tells me one thing. It behooves states and their the political actors within those states to really push these countries to put their money where their mouth is if they really want to have a strong functioning system of justice. The second thing that I think is really important about the way the ICC is set up is that, of course, under its current size and shape, it can only take on maybe 9 to 12 cases, active cases being investigated a year or prosecuted a year. So how does it effectuate justice globally? Well, this system that Victor brought up earlier called the system of complementarity is particularly critical. And the idea there is that the ICC becomes a bit of a mechanism to pressure governments and countries to begin to take on their own trials. The Rome Statute, which is the body of laws that establishes what is legal and illegal in the international criminal legal framework, is supposed to be what's called domesticated by those countries that sign on to the court. So they're supposed to change their own body of laws to be in harmony with this bigger international legal framework. And so in that way, ideas around what's legal and illegal begin to disseminate across the globe and ultimately gives this body of law that's been developed a much broader reach than it would have otherwise. Mm-hmm. One more?
Is there one more question? And then I think we should end there.
Yeah.
Okay. My question is, where do we stand on the international court?
We are a non-state party. Bill Clinton originally spoke favorably about the idea of an international criminal court in the mid-1980s, and as the Rome Conference of 1998 approached, we got cold feet. Madeleine Albright at one point told David Sheffer, the war crimes ambassador, to blow up the conference, metaphorically. We tried to water it down, the Rome Statute, and we succeeded in key dimensions, and so ICC supporters hoped it would be enough to get us to sign on and ratify. We didn't. So now it's a crucial question, because on Friday at 12:01, I guess, we won't find out, but we'll begin to maybe start to find out over the next months and years. The Obama administration has pursued a policy of constructive engagement with the court. We haven't signed on or become members yet, but we have selectively supported the ICC in the situations we deem to be politically convenient. In Darfur, the United States has actually supported investigations at the moments of our convenience, and in terms of lifting a serious part of the sanctions regime, as I spoke about, underscores how we are abandoning the court now because it's convenient for us. So the real question is, what will happen in terms of January 20th and moving on? I think the Trump administration will be no friend of the International Criminal Court. That said, though, if the Trump administration might see the political utility of using it against enemies, maybe we'll see selective support. And that underscores the importance of political will, but also the kind of ethical question of at what point does international justice become too politicized. And I think that in that case, it's incumbent upon citizens and activists to monitor the politics so we can understand it better.
Eric, any last words?
Well, that's just to thank you all. And there's a little promotion here. There is if we haven't put you to sleep or you want to learn more, on the 28th of March, PBS will be broadcasting up here a documentary called Dead Reckoning. It is a companion documentary to the book, and it sort of charts historically the development of international criminal justice. So if you'd like to tune in to PBS. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.